really that interested in socializing except with close family members. And they were educated at home. So all they had was each other in this little hothouse environment. And Nancy is the oldest, and she's brilliantly funny and wildly witty and kind of mean, more than kind of mean. And she's calling all the shots, and they're just like trying to, she's set the bar to a certain level, and they're just all trying to get up there. So also Nancy started making fun of their bombastic, overbearing father early on. And, you know, just he became toothless to them. So he was not really truly an authority figure. And their mother was kind of, in their words, vague. So they just kind of, it was as though no one said to them, you can't do whatever you want, which is what girls are taught, not only at home, but being socialized in schools. Girls are constantly told, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. That's not what girls do. You know, you just get this from an early age. You just absorb it all about all the things you can't be. And I don't think they got that. They just went and did exactly what they wanted to do.
Well, there is a certain irony in these parents almost cloistering these girls and then them going out and being trailblazing women, you know, for good or ill.
Yeah. Or ill. Yeah.
There's a coda at the end of this book where you write, the sisters could not know how much they helped a woman in her 60s reconnect with the small girl who wanted only to read about faraway places and to draw everything. They have my most profound gratitude.
They do. I mean, it really did connect me with all kinds of things. It was like one of the most profound things of my life to draw this book, because it put me so much back in touch with who I was when I was, you know, between like 8 and 12 years old.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we're talking today with comics artist and writer Mimi Pond. Her books include Over Easy, The Customer Is Always Wrong, and Do Admit, The Mitford Sisters and Me. Now, you're a big believer in hand lettering.
Yes.
There's not a single typeface in the book. It's all coming out of your pen.
Yes, yes. And I mean, I don't want to put anyone down who's like drawing digitally. I have an iPad. I finally got on the ball with Procreate and have done a few quick things with that. And it's a useful tool, but it also, it for me, it lacks the joy of sitting and drawing on paper. I mean, there's just something about your brain and the pen and the paper connecting that doesn't happen with electronically. And the lettering, honestly, was the easiest part, you know, because it's very kind of mechanical, as opposed to figuring out how to tell the story and then visually what would it look like. And I just wanted to avoid it being another graphic biography with talking heads. You know, it was a big challenge to get all this information across in ways that sucked people in and didn't let them go. And, you know, that's what I want, is like for people to like, no, I've got to keep going. This is just immersive. And my dad had a shitty lifelong job working for General Dynamics Convair in San Diego as a skilled blue collar worker. He helped assemble printed circuit boards that went in the nose cones of like Gemini missiles, Gemini and Apollo and all the ones that blow things up. And these are the precursors of computer motherboards. And it's just kind of crazy to think that he had some part in that. But it was just a crappy blue collar job, and he was creative, and he also needed more money and took a sign painting class at San Diego City College and started working on assignments and brought home these textbooks, these sign painting textbooks that were from like the 1910s. And I'm starting to look through these things, and I fell in love with letter forms and signage and graphic design because of that. And I've always loved that. And, you know, I started messing around with doing different kinds of lettering. And when I see digital fonts in graphic novels, I can tell that they're digital, because there's like, oh, there's that F again. It doesn't take that much longer to do it by hand than it does to do it digitally, is my thing.
There are a lot of visual allegories, visual tropes in the book. You know, you've drawn references to movie posters, romance comics, social realist art, the Bayeux Tapestry.
Yeah, I have and then the thing that really became the greatest tool for me was Pinterest, which everyone thinks of Pinterest as a place where women go plan their bachelorette parties or their, you know, kids' third birthday party. But it's just a digital bulletin board. It's just a digital place to store images on. So I have a Pinterest board that's called Strong Mitford Tea, where I just collected thousands and thousands of different kinds of images, everything from, you know, like Soviet propaganda to Baroque cartouches to all the pictures of all the sisters and all the people in their lives for reference and all the houses where they lived to, you know, like stock certificates or, you know, what is a British battleship from 1937 look like? You know, you have to know, you have to be able to draw it. You have to be able, that's the thing. If you're thinking about doing a graphic novel, just be prepared to have to draw everything, whether you like it or not. Like, people think, oh, I could just do a graphic novel, but there's a lot to it, including drawing things that don't necessarily bring you joy.
So while you were working on this book, BritBox came out with a TV series about the Mitford sisters called Outrageous. Your book has been getting better reviews than that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I did a cartoon review of Outrageous for thenewyorker.com. Anyone can go look at it. And what it misses, the biggest thing, is that they're not funny in this series. I mean, and that's the big draw, is that fascist or communist, duchess or writer, they're all screamingly funny. And it's just the usual kind of like sibling drama kind of stuff, instead of like being wildly witty and ahead of their time.
Well, you're obviously a serious wit yourself. And a lot of your fans were first introduced to your work in the National Lampoon's Funny Pages.
Right.
A favorite character in your comics was the wisecracking waitress who was drawn pretty closely from real life.
Oh, yes. Well, that was me. Mimi Pond's famous waitress school. Yeah, that was Sherry Flanagan, who was the cartoon editor there, was a great mentor of mine and basically taught me how to draw comics. I mean, I was already cartooning and stuff, but she basically taught me how to construct a comic strip. And I owe her a tremendous amount. And I got to meet all these other cartoonists like Roz Chast and Sam Gross. And she invited me to stay with her. So I went to visit. And then that was like the foot in the door I needed just to like up and move there from Oakland, where I was still working as a waitress. So yeah, I owe her my whole career, basically.
Yeah, she was Sherry Flanagan, who was famous for the Trots and Bonnie strip. She became one of the few women editors at the National Lampoon, and she was a big scholar of early 20th century comics.
Yes. Yeah, her stuff is great.
And then there was M.K. Brown, who did
M.K. Brown's fabulous.
Who did the Aunt Mary's Kitchen comic.
Yeah. I just adore her.
M.K. Brown went on to create animations for the Tracy Ullman show.
Yeah, before The Simpsons. There was her stuff, which was really great.
And wanted to touch on that. But first, you and your husband, Wayne White, appear in a documentary called Beauty is Embarrassing. It's a wild documentary. Paul Rubens and Matt Groening appear in the film, along with Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo.
Yeah, it's a great movie, actually. I think it launched 1,000 ships in its use of animation and music in telling the story. Neil Berkeley is the director, and he did a beautiful job with it.
The thing is, when you met Wayne White, you were a very successful cartoonist.
Yeah, I had just had the Valley Girl's Guide to Life had come out. I was doing more humor books in the 80s, which was like a thing. You know, it's like you just rode that wave as far as you could. You know, there was like 101 Uses for a Dead Cat and all these other little humor books people could buy for a few bucks. And the publishers were just jumping on that like crazy. So I was doing cartoons for the Village Voice, where I had another important woman editor mentor, Mary Peacock, who ran a style page called the V page. And she just gave me the whole page to do a full page cartoon, which was just fantastic. It was like having a full page ad for yourself in a widely circulated New York City newspaper that everyone saw. So that got the attention of an editor who called me up and had lunch with, and I was regaling him with stories of like growing up in San Diego with a bunch of dumbass surfer dudes, and I was imitating them. And he's like, we're looking for someone to do a humor book about Valley Girls. And I said, what's that? And he said, oh, it's this novelty song hit that Frank Zappa and his teenage daughter did. And I was like, oh, I had to go buy the record. I didn't have a record player at the time. I had to go to a friend's house, listen to it. I was like, oh, yeah, that, I can do that.
Hey, I was going to ask, when you did work for Adweek, was Stan Mack there at the time?
Oh, yeah, I love Stan. Stan's an old friend. And he did a cartoon about the night that Wayne and I met that's in his new collection that came out last year.
Because
he was there that night. Wayne, I was friends with Ron Howgie. Wayne and I were both independently friends of Ron Howgie. And I was like hanging out in Ron Howgie's apartment on Avenue B. And he said, I'm going to go to this puppet show down on the Bowery tonight. Do you want to go? I was like, oh, fine. Maybe I'll meet someone. And then Wayne did this crazy avant-garde puppet show, cardboard puppet show with a cardboard stage and these crazy puppets. And we all went to dinner at some Indian restaurant on 6th Street all together, including Stan. And, you know, I took one look at Wayne and I said, that's the guy for me. And so Stan did a cartoon about it. It wasn't so much about our meeting at the time. It was like Wayne's drama of what was going on in his life. But it's quite memorable. He also did a cartoon based on a story that I told him about going up to Condé Nast to deliver an illustration or something. And you could tell when you went to the elevator at Condé Nast who worked on which floor, whether it was Glamour or Mademoiselle or Vogue, like the way these ingenue interns would be dressed. And I got on with these two women in the elevator. And then the next floor, a woman got on with a little girl who was about 3 or 4. And it was like, oh, Mary, I haven't seen you in so long. Is this your little girl? Isn't she precious? Oh, she's just adorable. Little girl's just kind of like embarrassed and looking down. The woman gets off the next floor with her little girl. The elevator doors close, and one of the women turns to the other and says, ugliest child I've ever seen. The other one said, if it was mine, I'd throw it down a well.
Oh my gosh. You know, when I saw Beauty is Embarrassing, I thought back, and I was wondering if, you know, being John Malkovich, if Charlie Kaufman had seen Wayne White's puppet show when he cast John Cusack in that role.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Not that I know of, but that's interesting. Yeah, the whole puppeteering world is a strange little world of cheerful, backbiting, scheming. Like, because there's so few jobs. Like, they're all like super nerdy because they're puppeteers, like just like uber nerds. And they're all competing for the same tiny amount of jobs that are out there. It's pretty funny. In fact, Wayne had a really sweet puppeteering gig, a SAG commercial.
This is the Screen Actors Guild we're talking about?
Well, they had to hire SAG puppeteers because it was a SAG shoot. So for like laying under a table with a bottle on the end of a stick and waving it around, he got us health insurance for another 3 years. So that was a beautiful thing.
Wow.
That sweet, sweet SAG insurance, man.
Oh my gosh. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we're talking today with comics artist and writer Mimi Pond. Her books include Over Easy, The Customer Is Always Wrong, and Do Admit, The Mitford Sisters and Me. You were also doing full-page regular comics for 17 Magazine.
Yeah, a little later on in the 80s, I was doing that for like, I don't know, about 6 or 7 years. So that was really fun. The editor-in-chief of 17 at that point was an ex-nun who had very strict ideas about what you could and couldn't do.
Wow. That's an interesting juxtaposition.
So yeah, but I mean, I was working all the time doing illustrations and comics, and we moved from New York to LA in 1990, and my son was born in 1992 and my daughter was born in 1995. And I, you know, I looked up from that and my career was gone because print was dead. I mean, I hear people, other writers and editors, you know, who are part of that fallout complain about it all the time. It's like, it's like, brother, can you spare a dime? You know, it's like once we had a railroad, made it run, brother, can you spare a dime? It's like, remember us. We used to do big things.
Well, that's an interesting sort of narrative, because when you met Wayne White, he was a talented puppeteer, but certainly not the big name that you were at the time.
He was sleeping in a sleeping bag under a table in an apartment in Brooklyn when I met him. And I was the big shot then. And then he got the job on Pee-wee's Playhouse, and it just took off like a rocket.
Right. And Pee-wee's Playhouse, the first season, was just done in this cramped warehouse.
Yeah.
And Wayne...
There was a loft in
a loft
building on Broadway below Houston. And they had these ducts from refrigerated air conditioning trucks. They run these ducts up to like the fourth floor just to air condition the loft to make it so that they could film in it. And it had all these beams they had to shoot around because it was never meant to be a TV studio. So yeah, it was kind of a crazy seat of your pants situation for the first season.
Yeah, I mean, Wayne became the production designer for Pee-wee's Playhouse, and the look of the show, which is now very influential, at the time, it was pretty much Wayne along with comics artist Gary Panter,
right,
that did the look of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was really the genius of Paul, was that if he trusted you, then he trusted you to do whatever you wanted. The documentary about him is really genius. And, you know, we knew him, but we didn't. There were many things we didn't know about him that we learned by watching the documentary, like his childhood in Sarasota and going to the high school and the circus aspect and the theater, early theater in Sarasota. And that he had that relationship with that young painter, we didn't know any of that because he was very, very private. And, you know, we knew him professionally and we, you know, would socialize occasionally. And when I wanted to write an episode with Lynn Stewart, Miss Yvonne, it basically ruined me for writing for television because we wrote our episode and we gave it to them and they shot it. I thought, oh, this is how it works. This is great.
The full script.
Yeah, the full script. They just shot it. So that's what I mean, is like when he trusts you, he just trusts you.
And things were very different when you went on to write for other TV shows, like you wrote for the last season of the sitcom Designing Women.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a 3-month-old son. I'd never been a mother before. I'd never worked in an office before. I'd never worked on a TV show before as a staff member. And I wasn't getting any sleep. Linda Bloodworth was off winning the election for Bill Clinton. The inmates were running the asylum. And, you know, I'd rack my sleep-deprived brain to come up with ideas for episodes. And everything I said, they said, oh, we did that in season 2. We did that in season 3. I'm like, oh. So after like a 3-month trial period, I wrote one episode. But after 3 months, they let me go. And I was so happy.
When The Simpsons went from the Tracy Ullman show to its own primetime series, you wrote the very first episode, Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire.
Yes. We had met Matt through Gary Panter and, you know, hit it off because we're all cartoonists and everything. And then Matt had the show happen. And I guess he was asking his various cartoonist friends if they wanted to write an episode. And apparently I was the only one who said yes. They were like, called me and said, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. Like, well, how about a Christmas episode? I said, great, because I hate Christmas. So that'll be good. So that was about the extent of it, you know. And then I went in for the rewrite meeting on the lot at Fox, met Sam Simon and Mike Reese and Al Jean, who I'd known, unfortunately, at the Lampoon in New York. So that was already 2 strikes against me. And then the 3rd strike was that Sam Simon apparently was going through a divorce and didn't want any women around. But I didn't learn all that until about 15 years later, you know, which I spent kicking myself and beating myself up because, like, yeah, I guess I wasn't good enough because they didn't ask me to be on staff. And it wasn't me at all. It was a boys' club. You know, it was just one of those battles that Matt didn't want to fight with them because he was already fighting so many others. So I'm the turd in the punch bowl of the Simpsons story. Everyone wants to hear that it was a wonderful experience. Everyone had so much fun all the time. And you know it wasn't. You know, I mean, there's a lot of TV shows where people are just miserable fucks, you know? And so, you know, I kind of like dodged that bullet in a way. I also got thrown off the moving gravy train. Thanks a lot. Because I still get residual checks after all this time. And I think, oh my God, if I'd been on staff and written more episodes, I'd be so rich. The fact that I was denied the opportunity is what is the thing that hurts the most.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they had plenty of young men that went to work there that didn't have a whole lot in the way of experience just like me, but they kept them on and they got better.
Another weird experience was you worked on a feature for Disney that never got made.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds kind of cool. It was called Wildlife.
It was super cool. Wildlife. Yeah, it was fascinating in that, I mean, it paid really well while I was there. I was the first of six writers hired to write this feature-length animated movie, and the two directors were these two guys who chose me, which was really nice, and they were wonderful. But the idea was, it was basically an evil Andy Warhol type impresario is shooting a fashion spread in a Florida trailer park inhabited by talking animals, and he's got his muse with him, this bitchy woman who's dogging him about something. And he said, I could make a star out of anyone. And she said, oh yeah, I make a star out of that elephant. And the elephant has this beautiful voice, and he turns her into a disco diva, and she almost loses her soul. But then of course she redeems herself in the end. So that's the story. And I was having a great time working on that. And, you know, after, I don't know, a couple of months, they kicked me out of my ass, and there were like five more writers after me. Basically, it was too edgy for Disney. It was too New York and too gay and too not Disney, you know, was what it was. I mean, it might have been good for maybe Pixar or something. It would have been a great movie.
Well, I don't want to gloss over your earlier works. There's a two-volume graphic memoir that you wrote. The first volume is Over Easy, and the second is The Customer is Always Wrong.
Yes, and that was the book I had inside of me from the day I went to work at this restaurant in Oakland, Mama's Royal Cafe, in 1978. It just like embedded itself in me like that monster in Alien and was trying to get out for years and years. And I would like think, you know, I got to get started on this thing. I got to do it. And like I'd almost get into a car accident. I think, oh, God, I got to do that story before I die, you know. And eventually, when my kids were starting school, I was able to like have enough time to like, I thought about like everyone who ever worked at this restaurant where our manager was this guy about 10, 15 years older than the rest of us, who was like our groovy beatnik dad. And we all just worshiped him. And you got the job, not on the basis of your resume, but he would say, tell me a joke or a dream. You know, so everyone who worked there were all these people coming out of the same art school I did who needed jobs. So there was all these weirdos, creative weirdos who came to work at this restaurant. And it, I mean, I never could have worked at any other restaurant. It was so unique and different and super, super fun until it wasn't, you know, with all the drugs. But it was such a compelling experience that I was like, you know, I've got to do this. So when my kids were finally in school, I thought, well, this everyone said it should be a movie. Everyone who ever worked there said this is a movie. And I lived in LA long enough to know that even if I wrote a screenplay, the odds of it getting produced were like slim to none. And I was so tired of getting turned down with comics and illustration because print was dead that I was like, well, I'll just write it as a conventional piece of fiction. So I did, and my agent couldn't sell it. And I finally had to break down and admit to myself that it wanted to be a graphic novel. And I thought, nobody could do that. No one could draw that much. That's crazy. And then I did it. And it was really gratifying to do that and really fun. And it's still selling. Over Easy just came out in paperback. I have a Customer is Always Wrong mug for sale at Fish's Eddy. They also sell my mug that says Lion Whore. Which is also from Over Easy because there was a short order cook we worked with, ill-tempered short order cook who would all call us waitresses lion whores. Like you'd go and go, where's my toast? Well, if the lion whore had put her toast in the toaster when she put her order in, the lion whore would have toast now.
Oh, my Lord.
I also have lion whore merchandise for sale on my website, mimipond.com, where you can also order signed copies of Do Admit, and you can get Mitford Sisters tea towels, pins, and lion whore purses and buttons and patches.
Well, I think that every young person should have to work a customer service job for a couple of years.
I think so too. I think that should be like, instead of, you know, being drafted in the army, everyone should have to work in a restaurant.
Seriously, bartending or waitressing, that's like a sociology degree right there.
It is. It absolutely is. And the great thing about it for me was that, especially with the encouragement of this boss that I had, was you decided that, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I used to be an artist, now I'm just a waitress. You're like, no, I'm pretending to be a waitress. I'm acting in a part in a fabulous drama that's ongoing. You know, and that's how you got through it. It's like, you know, I'm going to play this part.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with comics artist and writer Mimi Pond. Her books include Over Easy, The Customer is Always Wrong, and Do Admit, The Mitford Sisters and Me. Mimi, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's been a delight. Thank you so much.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
Well, they can find signed copies of my book on mimipond.com, or they can buy the book wherever books are sold. I prefer bookshop.org to the behemoth, because you can choose any local bookstore to get the profit from the sale of whatever book you buy instead of the monster. And it keeps, you know, small businesses going, and we love our independent bookstores. So that's what I would recommend. Or, you know, just walk into your bookstore like people used to do.
All right. Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture. The top of 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 the top of
KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7